Good morning. This is Joshua Lopez, and today I'm joined by Matt Brunetta. We are here in Willis Library in the Oral History Office, and today we're going to be talking about the movement to ban fracking in Denton for an oral history project. Today is December 6th, 2019. And thank you for agreeing again to meet with me and to share your story.
Thanks.
I'm excited to hear it. So if you could just please start by telling me a little bit about who you are.
Okay. My name is Matt Pernetta. I'm a resident of Denton. I first moved up here back in the 90s, came to North Texas, moved away for a little bit, and came back somewhere about 2008. Because my wife and I had a daughter. We were thinking about having other kids, and when we moved back to Texas, we thought, Denton was kind of nice. Had a small town feel, but it was close enough to everything. And it also, for Texas, had enough people who were kind of liberal and progressive, and we thought, it'd be the closest we could get to having an environment that we wanted to live in and, be exposed to the kind of people we wanted to be with. Right now, I'm an analyst at a financial corporation. I work on reports to the Federal Reserve Board, basically the whole too big to fail tests. We do that, and I'm a candidate for Congress in District 26, which covers all of Denton proper, some of North Tarrant County, and most of Denton County.
That's so exciting. So just earlier in when you mentioned in your introduction, you said something about looking into how liberal Denton was. How important is that for you and your family?
It's really, important. One of the things, when we talk about, liberal and progressive, one of the things that is really kind of quietly part of that conversation is safety, right? We wanted to grow up, we wanted our kids to grow up in a place that was diverse, that they could, be themselves in. As a minority, I grew up in some small towns west of San Antonio when I was younger, where racism was prevalent, things like that. And having different ideas and, being different could be dangerous, sometimes. Denton has always been, well, when we moved here in the 90s, Denton was kind of this little far-off burg, and it was like an island away from Dallas, away from Fort Worth, and because of that, it was its own self-defined community, and there was a lot of artists and a lot of exploration of different ideas, and it was probably, the first time I ever got exposed to people who were wildly different than I was, and it kind of, opened your mind to things that you hadn't been exposed to growing up in Texas. So that was important, and I think there's still a lot of that element in Denton. It's changed a lot though, because, basically creep out from Dallas and everything like that, the whole, they traditionally call white flight, has kind of changed the attitude of Denton, whereas its mentality used to be primarily defined by students, philosophically, the two very liberal universities. Now they're kind of the minority in terms of, people who work in Frisco and Irving and all these other places.
Cool. And I really appreciated your discussion about safety, because I'm from El Paso, and so...
I lived in El Paso for a little while when I was a kid.
I've never been outside of El Paso, so it was that was safety, the way that you put it, especially after what happened in August in El Paso.
Yeah.
That was definitely a question moving. So I definitely, I agree with what you're saying. In that definition of safety, in connection to liberal and progressive views, how does the environment fit in?
That was something we didn't know what the impact was going to be when we first chose to come back. When I first moved to Denton, a lot of the water was well water, things like that. The quality of our resources was greatly different, because there was no fracking here at the time. And now there's a huge treatment plant. We get most of our water from surface water in Lake Ray Roberts and Lake Louisville. Back then it was wells. I grew up in San Antonio, and I remember, as far as environment goes, the first time I remember noticing that there was something different about this was the first time I took a shower when I got here. Because in San Antonio, the water's really hard, right? Mm-hmm. And now you can't tell the difference. But when I got here, it was really soft water. So I remember the first time I took a shower, I was like, how do I get this shampoo out of my hair? This feels weird. And it's kind of a hard thing to describe, but the feel of water makes a huge difference depending on, you know, what goes in it, how it's treated, whether it's from a well, whether, you know, pure, if you've ever drank pure spring water from a spring, you can kind of tell it's, you know, it's a different thing than tap water. So we always associated, Denton with being fairly, you know, environmentally, you know, safe. When we moved away, a lot of things happened at that time. And, you know, that's primarily when, fracking came into Denton. We missed that. When we first came here in the 90s, the geographical design of Denton, the effects of it weren't as detrimental. The air was relatively clean, it was breathable. There was a lot of agriculture out here, a lot of open fields, grass and everything. So if there was anything that bothered you, it'd be your allergies. It's different now because Denton, I'm sure someone's kind of discussed this, Denton is basically in a bowl. So as Dallas has become more, developed and spread out, and Fort Worth has become more spread out, you don't have those buffers. And, you know, there used to be like a 30-minute buffer from here to Fort Worth where you just drove and it was nothing but grass and cattle and, you know, big baled hay. From Denton to heading toward Dallas, there was nothing along 35 when I first moved here. You would drive for 15 minutes and then eventually you'd see some purple lights in the distance, and those were the lights on the what is now the Music City Mall. It used to be Vista Ridge Mall in Louisville. And that was how you knew you were almost somewhere, because it was all dark. There wasn't even lights on the on the highway. So when I talk about Denton being isolated, it was different. And because of that, you know, you didn't have the effects that we have of all the pollution. Now we have so many things that are basically, it's almost nonstop. There's always something on the way to Denton from Dallas, and the same way from Fort Worth. Because of that, because our highways are so terrible, we have traffic that's always backed up. So we have all those, you know, kind of emissions coming out. We have the brick plant here. We have fracking all over the place, and we have, you know, pollution from Fort Worth and Dallas. And when the winds blow, you would think it would normally go through, but even though this area is pretty flat, Denton is in a bowl. So all the pollutants from every place else basically come here and they sit here. So we get all that, plus, you know, what's happening with the, you know, with fracking. So we didn't know that, you know, this was an issue. When, you know, we lived in Los Angeles for a while where you can see the smog, right? And like a lot of people, they look out in the air, and if they can see blue sky, they go, oh, hey, it's safe, it's clean here. And you just go, you just assume everything's good. And that's what's deceptive about Denton. Everything changed, and things got significantly more toxic and dangerous. And to the naked eye, nobody really knew what was going on until it became critical. Mm.
So when did you first learn about fracking happening in Denton?
Probably about 2010 was when I first noticed it, and that was when, you know, people first started really talking about it. I think that was right around the times that they set the setbacks and everything. Mm-hmm. But once again, it was all very, it was almost a distanced thing, because most of the fracking was occurring out, you know, in the West area. I've got a friend who owns a ton, and I met him through being on planning and zoning. He owns a ton of land out there. And we were talking about, you know, how they want to develop this land, and we have this problem because there's all these wells out there. And, you know, one of the things that he mentioned was, you know, when all the companies came out here, he's like, the problem was they were just talking to ranchers. And these ranchers had like a bunch of land. And a lot of that land that's west of Denton is dirt and clay and, you know, mesquite trees and, you know, basically just the detritus that you can't even graze anything on. So when somebody says, hey, we're going to put something here on this land that's really not worth much, they went, oh, okay, yeah, we'll make some money. You know, because at the time, nobody figured that this would ever develop out here. The funny thing about Denton is Denton has marketed itself as the heart of the Golden Triangle. And the Golden Triangle are, you know, is Dallas, Fort Worth, and Denton. And they call it that because, you know, before, you know, out in Hillsboro, the, you know, the 35 split up. One goes to Fort Worth, one goes to Dallas. And then they recombine on the way to, you know, to Oklahoma. And they recombine at Denton. So ever since I first moved here for probably 20 years, you know, whenever, ever since they did that to 35, they've always said, Denton's the heart of the Golden Triangle, and someday we're going to be blah, blah, blah. And everyone, yeah, someday. Nobody's ever going to move out here. And those ranchers never saw it happening. I heard somebody once say, you know, the colony, not the colony, yeah, I think the colony has farther setbacks. Trophy Club, South Lake has like 1,000-foot setback. And a setback is the distance, you know, you can build a house, you can drill a well close to a house, or you can build a house close to a well. And they set those there. And people always, you know, make it sound like South Lake is more progressive environmentally. No, they're not. That's a financial decision, right? Somebody years ago, when, you know, people started approaching them, you know, for fracking, looked at the map and went, no, because we can take a few $1,000s for mineral rights here, or if we sit on this for a few years, we will make millions of dollars, and fracking will actually make this land worth nothing. And those were the two different decisions, right? You had ranchers out in West Denton who figured nothing would ever happen here, and the people to the southeast of us went, no, this is going to be big. We connect Dallas to Fort Worth. We're sitting on this land. When I became, you know, and like I said, so when the discussions of, you know, setbacks and everything were kind of there. Once again, at the time, it didn't really impact me because a lot of Denton itself, Denton proper, if you look at the map of where the wells are, you know, if you live at UNT, if you live, you know, where I live, you know, over by the fairgrounds and all this kind of stuff, there's no wells there. They never put wells there. And I actually presented this to City Council a few weeks ago. It's like, you know, if you look at Denton proper, we by default have a setback of over 1,000 feet because there's no wells here. The problem is future citizens are going to be exposed to this. So for me, it wasn't a thing where it was top of mind. We knew there was pollution. We knew the pollution was getting worse. For me, even the full impact didn't hit me until after the fracking ban when we discovered my son had asthma. This is a long answer to your question.
Oh, no. So I guess we can transition to that. What are some of your memories of that campaign to ban fracking within city limits?
You know, it's kind of funny because I do a lot of speaking on fracking setbacks, the environment. I've gone before City Council a few times. I've made a few really critical protest votes on planning and zoning that actually set what's happening right now into motion in the City Council. I've been very outspoken about it because of, you know, my family and the fact that they're, you know, despite this critical issue, we don't have a pediatric emergency facility in Denton. But what's funny is, like, you know, we look back on it and, you know, honestly, I went to, you know, spent a few times at a few rallies, made posts and talked to people about it. It was, you know, it was a vote that I figured that felt like at the time like it was a shoo-in. So it was mostly just kind of discussion. When people ask me about, you know, hey, what did you do during, you know, during the fracking ban and everything, you know, It's like, well, not a lot. And it's kind of funny. I always compare it to people going, hey, Grandpa, tell me about fighting in the Civil War. And going, you know, I was around during the war, but let me tell you about Reconstruction and everything. You know, because it was everything that happened subsequent to that that really is where, you know, when, you know, HB 40 was passed specifically to overturn this and everything, where suddenly, you know, I used to, because we're in Denton, because, you know, I always grew up as, you know, feeling that Denton was liberal and progressive, the idea of the fracking ban seemed like a no-brainer. To me, it was always like, you know, okay, everybody I knew supported this. You know, this was going to happen, and we're going to be able to protect people. And, you know, miraculously, our air would get better afterwards. When everything happened after that, you started to realize just how big... and it is a conspiracy, you know, it was to overturn this, how much money is being spent outside of Denton that affects us and hurts us, and, you know, how hard it is to overcome that, and, you know, how prevalent that is, you know, around the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned attending some rallies and like, posting on social media.
Mm-hmm.
When you posted on social media, what kinds of discussions did you have around the topic of fracking?
It was simply that, you know, I was kind of sheltered, right? Mm-hmm. So like I said, most of my friends are like me and everything. So, hey, there's a fracking ban. It's really important, you know. And, you know, we'd have the discussion in terms of being environmentalists. Because, you know, I spent some time in, you know, Los Angeles. And I've always, you know, we've always been environmentalists. You know, and it was fairly easy to be environmentalist at the time. And, you know, you could go to a rally, you could go hold a sign, you could, you know, do a couple of things just as an outside thing. Hey, I don't know anybody here, but there's going to be a thing there. Hey, let's go there. So that way, you know, it's kind of like when people go to the Women's March or people go to, you know, March for Our Lives and everything. Well, you know, I'm not really involved in this, but there's this thing. We should go check this out and just, you know,
mm-hmm.
and be there. And it was kind of like that. When I would, you know, write about it or post about it or talk to friends about it, there was never anything, you know, particularly vitriolic about it, because everyone went, oh yeah, this is about clean air and water. Okay. You know, this is about putting, you know, gas wells, you know, close to houses. Okay. And you know, there were a lot of people who went, well, I wouldn't want a gas station, you know, 200 feet from my house. It only makes sense. So it wasn't anything that was, you know, particularly, you know, exciting, you know, for a lot of us, you know, because, you know, in essence, it was just like, this thing's going to pass and we're good, you know. It just seemed to make sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you remember or have any memories of any specific rallies that you attended?
There was one that was outside of the Civic Center, you know, that I remember, and that was, you know, but once again, it was, you know, it was just there was no police involved, and it wasn't anything, you know, particularly dangerous, or, you know, it wasn't a powder keg. It was just, you know, hey, we're here to be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ever, even as a voter, were you ever kind of confronted with or kind of came into contact with anyone from the opposition that tried to persuade you to vote against the ban?
There were people outside the polls and everything that would, you know, kind of come up and they would, you know, run up and talk to you. One of the interesting things was, and, you know, for everyone who was, like, in, you know, involved in it, a lot of people go, you know, when this vote happened, it was all about the fracking ban. What's funny is, you know, I follow, you know, because I'm involved in politics, I follow elections and turnout and things like that. 2014 was an off year, right? We had a gubernatorial election that year. Wendy Davis was going up against Greg Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. You know, and that was a huge landslide for Abbott. But, you know, overall in Denton County, the turnout that year was like 35%, right, which is pretty low, and that's about standard for an off year. But if you look at the city of Denton itself, the turnout was huge. You know, there was a lot of, there's a lot of precincts. My precincts turned out something like 45%. You know, there were others, you know, there was in the 40s, almost 50%. And in Southwest Denton, where there's, you know, where a lot of people were heavily invested in the fact that they wanted Wells there, the turnout there was like 60%, which is huge, right? But the funny thing was, when I would talk to people about, hey, are you voting, are you voting, are you voting? You know, people go, yeah, I'm going to vote for the fracking ban. I'm like, okay, well, you know, but one of the things that's always forgotten is that on that same bill, on that same ballot, was the proposition to allow liquor sales in Denton. So, you know, you would have people going, oh, yeah, I'm going to go vote for this. And then you'd also have to go, hey, okay, but the fracking ban is on here too. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. You know, and you look at it, it's like, okay, well, there was a 75% yay vote, you know, for liquor sales, you know, and the fracking, you know, ban. It was like 60-40. I think like 14,000 people voted for it. You know, 10,000 voted against it. So, you know, when you went to the polls and everything, you know, people would run out to you and try and tell you this. Yeah, okay. But it wasn't for me. I always brush people off because I know what I'm going to do when I get there, and I don't want to talk to anybody. You know, there were a few people in passing who would kind of talk about it, and they would talk about the fact that it was... that, you know, well, what it's really about is property rights, and what you're arguing is to take away somebody's ability to, you know, develop their property as they see fit. And it's like, okay, no, you know, disagree with you on that. You know, we have a larger responsibility. So there was nothing, I never felt threatened by anybody. You know, I think as long as you weren't out near a pad site, they just wanted to, you know, friend up to you and get you to go, no.
what are some of your memories about Election Day and the news about the ban being passed?
Well, you know, we're in Denton, right? So we're not in Dallas. And that was like the thing. On Election Day, you know, we went and voted for it. And then it was, you know, literally just going, hey, has anybody heard anything? Hey, has anybody heard anything? Hey, has anybody heard anything? You know, looking for results. Because the results, they don't post anything until, you know, until election night and stuff. So, you know, back then it was basically just waiting until 7 o'clock and then just, you know, refreshing, you know, your computer and seeing if anybody on Facebook had heard anything. And then after that, just going, okay, well, they're saying it. We'll wait until the DRC updates it and everything. And, you know, when we saw that it passed, it was like, oh, good, you know. Because I think it was on Election Day where you kind of started to go, could it fail? You know. And, yeah, that was good. That was kind of the thing. It was scary, you know, for a bit there. Because... like I said, unfortunately, because we're not in Dallas and they don't have the 5 o'clock news, you know, talking about this one thing, it was something where we had to just talk to each other and find out who knew something, you know.
So before it was announced that it passed, did it feel like particularly tense as the day went on?
When what? I'm sorry.
As the day kind of went on, before the news of the ban had passed, like, was it kind of tense?
I don't think it felt tense. It was just nervousness, you know? Cause you know, the question was, a lot of people have attended rallies and a lot of people signed a petition and a lot of people talk about, you know, how much they want this thing to happen. Are they going to actually show up to vote? And That was the nervousness because, you know, one of the funny things about Denton is that as liberal and you know, progressive as it is, a lot of the people who consider themselves activists don't really vote. You know, and that's one of the things that's always held and has always been frustrating about this. You know, it's like, okay, I understand you're saying this and you want to argue this, but you actually have to go and vote to get this thing done. So for me, it was more, are they going to show up? And they did, you know. But once again, you only know your friends and your group and, you know, whoever's, you know, in a freaking online chat group and everything about it. Yeah.
Do you feel that there was that there were people who maybe didn't feel affected by the fracking ban?
Yeah. That's the problem that we have right now. You know, people don't understand the environmental impact and the health impact of what's going on. You know, I've had these arguments with people, and you know, I've had, you know, I remember someone who you know, is fairly active in the community arguing with me about this, you know, and there was this very dismissive. So, do you really think, you know, this pollution gave your son asthma? And you know, I kind of had to go, you are aware that, you know, asthma isn't something that you just get. There are triggering things that contribute to this. It's almost like diabetes. You know, you can be predisposed to it, but if you eat right and you exercise and everything, you might never have a difference. You know, it's these things that, you know, that impact you. So a lot of people, you know, I don't think they really understood what the long term effects would be, because the whole thing was. So there was already some things in place, right?
Yeah.
And this is what made it kind of difficult to make people understand. There were already setbacks in place, right? And the setbacks were 1,000 feet, you know, for wells, which meant that you couldn't come. A driller couldn't come into town and put in a new well within 1,000 feet of anything, right? So that was already off the table. And if you lived in, you know, a fairly dense neighborhood and everything, you knew that wasn't going to happen. The other thing was, you know, reverse setbacks. The reverse setbacks were 250 feet. Well, as long as you didn't, you know, if you already owned your home and you weren't already near a well, then it didn't make a difference, right? But, you know, what these things didn't account for was, say, out on Bonnie Bray, where there was a pad site right next to, you know, a park. You know, that was just open land. Nobody lived there. You know, somebody could put on, you know, could, you know, let somebody put in a well there, and they didn't understand how much that contaminated this park where kids took their, and people took their kids to play, you know. So, you know, I think that was a thing. People didn't understand what the real impact was going to be, because they figured, well, there's already not going to be somebody coming into my town, and we already have these rules, and this is just a bunch of tree-hugging, you know, hippies wanting to, you know, have a party and claim they're doing something. And that's one of the things that you always have to overcome when you're talking about, you know, the environment, mm-hmm. particularly in Texas, because we all know that, you know, Texas economy was built on oil, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. So, how did you learn about the passage of HB 40?
I don't remember specifically what it was. Everybody was happy, you know, fracking ban was going to go into place, and then you just started hearing rumblings that there was going to be something, you know, something that was going to, that they were going to overturn it in Austin, and it seemed odd, you know. It's like that this thing could happen. Like, why would somebody in Austin be spending that much time and money to affect something in Denton? We were a small town, you know. But then you thought, okay, but all we're doing is protecting ourselves. This would never pass, and I think that was, you know. That was the thing. Every time it came up, it was always one of those things where you went, this will never pass. There's no way address this, because a town has a right to, you know, to protect itself, to protect its environment. And it was just, you know, a series of, you know, like you'd see an article in the DRC and people would start talking about it, and it was just, okay, all right, you know. But once again, you know, for this one, it just didn't seem like it was going to happen. You didn't have the idea that there was as much money behind it as possible. And you know, to be honest, like a lot of people, you don't, you know, most people don't understand the impact that state politics have on their lives. You know, whenever people talk about, you know, the Texas legislature and, you know, the Texas state senate, it's this, you know, obtuse kind of thing. You know, it's, well, these are people we don't even know about. You know, everybody focuses on things that are going on in Washington. They don't realize that all of the decisions, you know, and over the last, 5 years, it's been a huge awakening for people. Because whether we're talking about HB 40 for, you know, for the environment, our ability to, you know, to have local control, or, you know, the SB 4, the Show Us Your Papers bill, which, you know, allowed people to discriminate openly, or, you know, the attempts at the bathroom bill, or, you know, the way that they are at the state chipping away at women's reproductive rights and everything, you know, suddenly you realize that all these things, you know, this Jeffersonian idea of whatever is not at the federal level is, you know, relegated to the states, and you realize that all of our protections are taking place at the state. Holy crap, now we know. And I think for me, HB 40 was probably the first thing that made me go, you know, what the hell is happening here? And that's, you know, when, you know, really started digging into, you know, what really ran this town, and, you know, started checking into exactly who Myra Crownover was, and how this representative who basically covered, whose district was almost entirely Denton, could turn her back on her constituency. And, you know, once I started following the paper trail and the money trail on that one, that was the big thing. You know, when I talk about the Civil War versus, you know, Reconstruction, those are the you know, the tentacles that kind of go on forever. And you know, it's like it is a lot. There, you know, the Civil War is kind of a big comparison. You know, because you go, hey, we had this battle and we thought we won the battle. But then somebody came and shot the man in the back of the head at the theater, you know. So, give me a second there. Getting over a cold, and sometimes I have coughing fits. Okay, I think I'll be okay.
Did you want to maybe, like, take a pause and then go ahead?
Yeah,
I'm going to
blow my nose.
Yeah,
is there
sure.
a bathroom with my...
And... Okay, so we're returning from our break. And yeah, we were talking about HB 40.
HB 40.
And if you want, we can just start with your reactions to it. What were you feeling when you found out about it passing?
I was angry. And I think that kind of started the whole thing of, you know, exactly how did this happen? Because, you know, like a lot of people, you know, state politics was this obtuse thing. And then, you know, I started really kind of checking into, you know, exactly, you know, who this person was that, you know, that was representing us. And it was Myra Crownover. And it's kind of funny because it was after HB 40 passed, you know, kind of became aware of a lot of the things that were in play when the fracking ban was, you know, out there. I don't think, you know, the big oil industry and everything took it seriously at first. I think a lot of people thought that this thing wouldn't pass. And you can tell, because you can tell if you look at the numbers. Myra Crownover was running for office. In her campaign at that time, I think, and this is just the money that I can tie specifically to a company or to a PAC. This is not, you know, the individuals, because, you know, we'd have to dig really far into that. There was $40,000 that she took in total from oil and gas PACs. Which, you know, is standard. But the interesting thing is that somewhere around mid-September, when it finally started to look like this thing was going to pass, Oil and Gas PAC started donating heavily to her. In fact, from mid-September to the end of her campaign fundraising season, she got about 20,000. Whereas the first 9 months out of the year, she got somewhere a little bit under 20,000. From mid-September on, she got another 20, and that 20 was basically to ensure where her vote went when HB 40 was going to pass. And I don't know if anybody's talked to you about this, but HB 40 wasn't something that was just built out of Austin, right? Mm-hmm. The oil and gas industry has a group. I think they're called American Legislative Executive Council or something like that. I know the acronym is ALEC. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they keep an eye out. It's basically a group that does, kind of lobby work and all that kind of stuff. They keep an eye out for anything that threatens the oil industry. And this bill was basically prepackaged already, exactly how to come at it, come at us with HB 40. It wasn't written in Austin. So, between Myra Crownover's, vote being bought, because really there was no mandate from her constituency to vote for HB 40. She could have voted no on it, but she didn't. One of the other things was Myra Crownover made her money in oil and gas. She's been the vice president of a company called Robinson Drilling since 2004. So she's made tons and tons of cash, and she actually makes money based on fracking and things like that. She was one of the people that helped beat other bills that would have kept the fracking industry from having to adhere to federal guidelines on pollution. All this stuff was already in place, and they have tentacles right now. I'm sure you've talked to if you guys have talked to, some of the protesters, particularly like Cindy Spoon, who's really active, everything that happened during the fracking ban, all the people that, protested, whether, it was Adam and Tara Lynn Hunter and everything sitting, at a gate, or, the Gomez's or whoever, chaining themselves to a facility. A bill passed this year in Texas that makes that a felony. Like, you can do 10 years in jail for that, and it's a very vague thing that says, if you impair, the flow or, the operations for oil and gas. I mean, it does away with free speech, and that is also the American Legislative Executive Council, ALEC. They also did that. They enacted that in Louisiana first. Cindy is a friend of mine, got arrested for, being on a canoe and, in open water, protesting. And, you can spend more time in jail for chaining yourself to the gate at a pad site. You can be in jail for longer than you can for murdering somebody in Texas. Mm-hmm. So that's been a big deal, and that's been one of the things that kind of tied everything together. It's one of the reasons I'm running for office, when you start connecting all those dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and that was going to be my next question. How did all of that kind of shape your perspectives and your outlooks politically?
Well, as I mentioned, Denton does not have a pediatric emergency ward, right? The closest one is Cook's in Fort Worth. Where people say all politics is local, and one of the things that I always amend that, and I say all politics is personal, because once you start, we understood the corruption and everything, and all the outside influences and how everything is bought and paid for in Texas. A couple of years ago, back in 2017, my son, at the beginning of the school year, got a cold, and we thought, okay, well, he got a cold, and he kept on saying he didn't want to go back to school, he wasn't feeling good, and, you know, we thought he was faking, because no kid wants to go back to school, and finally, one day, he said he was going to stay home, and I said, you know, well, fine, if you stay home, grandma's going to take you to the doctor, and he said, okay, and we're like, that's weird. It was the day of the total solar eclipse, right? Mm. And I remember that day because I'd forgotten to buy eclipse glasses, and I was like, you know, my wife and I were having this big, how are the kids going to watch the eclipse? I don't know. It's my fault. I went to work that day. I figured they'd have something at school, but my son wasn't going to school. I felt bad, but my mother-in-law called me at work and said, you need to come back right now. And I said, what's going on? She said they'd given him, five or six breathing treatments, and he wasn't getting better. That is, blood oxygen was like somewhere like 80%, which is dangerously low for a child. And she said they were taking him to Cook's. And, that was it. We spent, they admitted him to Cook's, and he wound up spending, 5 days in there. It was dangerous. We thought he was going to die for a little while. And when we were in there, the doctors kept coming back and saying, he's got a breathing condition, He's got a breathing condition. And I remember after days, I went, I don't know what this means. A breathing condition doesn't mean anything. What is that? And finally, one of the doctors said, look, it looks like your son has asthma. We're not going to say he has asthma because we're going to treat it like we would treat, anything. But the minute we put that he has asthma down, he has a pre-existing condition. And then he's got that for the rest of his life. So we will treat it and see if maybe this is something he'll grow out of, but otherwise, this is what the problem is. And it was that, right? So, living in Denton, which has the worst quality air in Texas, we are rated an F by the American Lung Association, which I actually fought with the Dallas Morning News one time. I was doing a panel with their editorial staff, and they went, where do you get that? And somebody else went, oh, this is from Facebook groups. No, it's not. It's the American Lung Association. When the air turns, he starts wheezing. And this kid who used to love to run in the fun run things at school and everything like that, the next year when we had fun run, he got 8 laps in and he was, gassed. And it was, it was the combination of all these things coming together, right? The environment. Basically, we have people who are poisoning our air and water, and because they're poisoning our air and water, my child gets sick and he could die. It was healthcare, because that year, we spent between premiums and deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses and everything, we spent $15,000 keeping my son alive. And, my first car was, $9,000, and I had 6 years to pay it off, and it lasted me 18 years. And it was also the fact that all of this was happening, whether our expensive health care, the fact that, we have people poisoning our air and water, and all this is happening because politicians around here take money from PACs, and they pass laws that are written by those, by organizations paid for by those PACs to hurt us, and they tell us everything's fine, and it's not. And it's legal. This is dark money, impacting our lives and hurting our families, and that's kind of one of the things that got me into politics, whether it was that or SB4. There was a huge line where you could point at every detrimental thing that had passed. We almost had the bathroom bill because politicians were taking money from this group and this group and this group, to restrict the rights of other people, and that's kind of what got me, into this. That and the fact that, I'd started spending time just drawing direct lines, connecting the dots isn't even a, when you're a kid, and, it comes from those little drawings, right? Hey, you connect the dots, and all these dots eventually come together, and they form, a man or an elephant or whatever. It's not even that complex anymore. The dots go from pack to pack to pack. To agency that writes a law this agency hands it to a person, and it all winds up with this politician. The dots don't form some abstract figure when you're done. They form a straight line, and that's wrong.
Do you feel like maybe in Denton there were some positive outcomes from HB 40 being passed? Maybe some things that, or any kind of forms of resilience maybe that you saw?
I think if anything positive came from it, I think it woke up a lot of people to what is really happening. You know, I think it woke up a lot of people to the idea that the things that we do to protect ourselves are in danger, and it made people really understand how corrupt things are. You know, I think that was the first thing that made people understand how much influence somebody has when they go to Austin, and how much that influence changes from when the time they're here. They shake hands and they tell you that they, you know, support what you're doing, they believe what you're doing, but then the minute they're 3 hours away, everything changes. So I think that was that. I think, you know, organization has gotten better in terms of people, you know, communicating what's dangerous about the air, what's dangerous about things that are happening here. People pay attention more, you know. It's no longer abstract, you know. And you know, a good example of this is, whereas it used to be hard to get people to really understand the impact of putting wells in South Denton, you know, and some people would pay attention, some people wouldn't. Now you have situations where, you know, people pay attention to what's going to happen to a chicken processing plant here. And, you know, you had a lot of people, you know, contact their city council people, you know, about Tyson coming in. And it also made people understand how important it is to have to city council people that are responsive. You know, we've got some people on city council right now that, you know, are responsive, and they listen to people, they talk to people. Right now, you know, out of the people on council, I know that there's four people that I could get to answer me in, you know, 10 minutes. You know, another one that I could get within half an hour. But, you know, and there's at least four that will sincerely listen to what, you know, I have to say if it's important. And I'm not unique in that. There's a lot of people that are the same way. They make a point to be more engaged civically. They know their city council person's name. They know who on city council, you know, is sympathetic to their cause, and you know, they can elicit change that way. And that's actually happening right now, because, you know, I mentioned the tentacles of the fracking ban are still going on. They are still going on right now. We have a vote coming up in January based on some things, you know, that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from all that.
Mm-hmm. And what are, if you don't mind, what are some of those things?
Okay, so as I mentioned, we have setbacks of 1,000 feet, which means that somebody can't come into Denton itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And drill. But the reverse setbacks are different, which means that a reverse setback is how close a person can build a house to an existing gas well or gas site. The setbacks were set back in like 2009, so they're 250 feet. Which is not very far, you know. You know, I, you know, it's what 80. What is that? Something like 100. I can't do the math. 250 feet. That's like what, like 80 yards or something like that. You know, yeah. It's tricky to divide by 250. Anyway, it's a chip shot in golf. But 250 feet isn't far, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's less than a football field.
Mm-hmm.
You know. It is significantly less than a football field. You know, it's not even the distance from end zone to end zone. So anyway, those were set like 10 years ago, and we haven't had, you know, any progress on that. About last year, about this time, like run around last December, I sit on planning and zoning, and planning and zoning, you know, votes on whether or not we can, you know, put specific types of, housing or buildings or whatever close to other types of housing. It's the map for how we lay out the town, right? We're not going to put a industrial, you know, plant right next to, an old folks home, right? There was something that came before planning and zoning last year, and it was a apartment complex that's, you know, up on Windsor and 35. And when you looked at the plant, you know, the thing was like, oh, hey, there's a fracking well here, okay? But we don't think that that's very active right now, you know? So we'll put this building here, and it's going to be within, you know, it'll be 450 feet, which is close, you know, but there's nothing we can do about it. But we started asking questions and went, well, what happens if they decide to start drilling here again? They're like, well, you know, they'll have to, you know, get an approval and they can do this, okay. Well, how big is this pad site, you know? Because the distance is from this well to this building, but this pad site is bigger, you know? And they said, well, technically they can drill anywhere on the pad site. So it's like, so what would happen is they could technically start a new well, and that well would be literally 250 feet. From a wall, and we don't know who's on the other side of that wall. It could be a baby, it could be whatever, and several of us voted against it. Now, we didn't get enough to overturn it, but we made the point that, you know, we made the point that this was wrong, and it started a conversation, because one of the things is there was no, there was technically no legal grounds for us to oppose it, because even the closest it was would be within, you know, that distance. But it started the conversation, and the conversation went back to city council. And when it got to city council, they did a study, and they decided to expand our setbacks distances to 500 feet. And that was a battle, because, you know, 500 feet is better than 200. Let's take the 500 and work forward. You know, that passed a few weeks ago. It should have gone into effect this week. But the mayor put in a thing to reconsider it. If you vote for something and your side prevails, right, like, you know, I say chocolate's better than peanut butter and I get four people to agree with me and your three people, don't win. Say, you know, you come up to me and go, you know, are you sure? Try this peanut butter. I can always go, you know what? Even though we win, because I'm on the winning side, I can open this thing up for a vote again, okay? I'm going to put in a motion to reconsider, and now let's see which is better, chocolate or peanut butter, you know, because in this world, Reese's don't exist. but that's kind of what happened, right? The mayor voted for this 500-foot new regulation, and then he was approached by somebody, and they put up for reconsideration, and now this ordinance that was supposed to go into effect, this week, is now revoked, and they're going to revisit it in, you know, January, and we don't know what's going to happen now. It could go back to 250. It could be some strange regulation that, you know, allows for more, you know, builds to go in. On planning and zoning, on our submission, we looked at the law, and one of the laws said, you know, that there could never be any building within 500 feet. And one of the questions we asked was, well, what if your house is already within 500 feet? What if your house burns down? You know, can you rebuild? And the city said no. And we went, well, we can't pass that. We would be open to litigation and all this kind of stuff. So we put in a thing that said, you know, if you're already there, you know, and a natural disaster happens or whatever, you can rebuild. City Council didn't pass that one. They passed something more restrictive, and that bothers me. I almost kind of feel like they passed the more restrictive one on purpose, knowing that they could come back and flip it back over. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, you know, we I've been making the point that, you know, we put in something in motion. You guys draft that language, and you vote on that. The issue is that between now and the time they vote on it, which will be sometime in the middle of January, legally speaking, if somebody wants to put in a development that's within 500 feet, but more than 250 feet, as long as it's approved between now and January, they are legally protected. I'm on planning and zoning. We have a huge docket next week, and my fear is that basically this is all a stall tactic to get a bunch of people to put in dangerous buildings before that's outlawed. We'll see what happens. But, you know, when I talk about the tentacles of it, we're still fighting this fight. There are things the city can do. There are things we can do as citizens, things we should be doing as citizens. And, you know, even if we get to 500, that's not the end. You know, there are things that we should be doing to increase our air quality monitoring. We should be doing soil testing and everything. Ultimately, the thing that happens, though, is wherever we are right now is, interestingly enough, out of our hands, right? For all the battle that we have right now, if you talk to the well owners, which I have, their whole thing is, well, we can pass this stuff, but at this point, there's not much drilling in Denton. You know, the Barnett Shale is pretty much dead and dried out. Most of those, you know, vertical wells, they're not producing anything now. So, what happened with HB 40? What happened with, you know, the fracking ban and everything? All it did was give people the opportunity to continue to drain us dry, and now they're all moving to the Permian Basin. So, you know, it's like if we get, you know, if we get our regulations passed and everything, it'll be great. But it's almost a Pyrrhic victory because they're not doing much production here anymore. And interestingly enough, a lot of those farmers or a lot of those ranchers, those people who kind of let wells go up on their land and everything, they were made promises about infrastructure changes that would happen from the people that, you know, were, you know, using their rights. And those are never going to get, you know, done because, you know, it's people come in, use our resources, leave, and they've left a lot of damaged area in Denton, and they don't care anymore.
Yeah. And when did you start getting involved with planning and zoning?
Well, I've been on planning and zoning for a little bit over a year now. And that one came about because, you know, I've been pretty active in the community for everything for the last few years. It seems like forever now. But when I, after the 2000, what year are we in? After the 2018 municipal elections, you know, when city council people come up, they can nominate people. And I was nominated by a city council person. And, you know, specifically her thing was, I would like you to go on planning and zoning. Because I've done a lot of work, you know, for her campaign and other, you know, and other candidates. And I remember when I, you know, when she came to me, my thought was like, oh, I wanted Parks and Rec. You know, planning and zoning seems, it just seems like a lot of work. And it is, because, you know, that one, that commission meets probably more than any other commission in, you know, in town. Some of them meet like once quarterly, sometimes once a month, sometimes once only if there's an issue on the docket. We meet at least twice a month, sometimes more, depending on, you know, we did a rezoning, complete rezoning of the city earlier this year. But, you know, I was nominated to that, and, you know, when we had the conversation about, you know, I was like, are you sure you want me on planning and zoning? You know, I know a lot about, you know, real estate financing and everything like that, but, you know, is this the fit that you want? And the answer was, you know, I know that you'll get up there and you'll actually represent the people and not developers, and that's what we need. And so it's been, you know, it's been that for the last year, and it's, you know, it's been fun because it's not just environmental stuff. It's you know, things that impact affordable housing, and, you know, whether or not we, you know, just trample all over the rural area outside of Denton or what. So and you know, the cool thing is being on that has given me access to city and staff, and, you know, whenever activist questions come up, you know, I can get somebody on the phone and go, hey, where do I look for this? And I can, you know, go to city attorneys or, you know, city staff and get feedback on exactly how something led to where it is today. So that's important.
So looking back at all of this and all of your own experiences and the experiences of the fracking ban, what do you think are some of the lessons to be learned from all of it?
(Clears throat) lessons to be learned. You know, diligence is the big thing. One thing that, and this is a kind of a cynical thing for me. One thing that I learned more than anything when it comes to politics is to make sure that I'm not preaching a pat message to the converted. One thing that I have learned is that all the decisions that are made by people who don't necessarily fit my, you know, my philosophical bent are made based on money, you know. And that sounds like a very obvious thing to say, right? You know, like, you know, like it's all money. And it is. And a lot of people kind of, you know, say that and think that, and they'll go, well, it's all money. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing you can do. We're going to make this point. One of the things I always tell people is like, okay, this is what you're going to say. This is what they're expecting you to say. This is a real feel-good idea that everyone should morally be behind. We need to reframe this. And one of the examples that I used when I went before city council to discuss setbacks earlier was this. I know that city council is worried about developers not being able to make money off their land, right? And they're worried about passing something that, you know, that will inhibit, you know, tax base. One of the things that I looked at was, here is a map of what Denton is and what Denton's going to be. What we are voting on is what Denton's going to be. Within the city, we already have an existing 1,000-foot setback just by default because all this was developed first. What we're trying to do is defend the people who are going to be future city Denton residents. And because of that, if we don't pass this setback, what we're doing is exposing all these people to, you know, carcinogens, you know, and things like that. Once those, you know, we don't know the long-term effects. We do know that these things, you know, when people are exposed to them, cause cancer, cause asthma. So once these clusters start coming up in 10 years, 5 years, whatever, somebody's going to sue. And that lawsuit will be a class action lawsuit. And because city council knows right now that 500 isn't a safe number, but is at least a start, if we don't put in a study to make a more informed decision, we are negligent. And once we are negligent, and it is on the record that we are aware that this might be an issue, people will sue, and we are exposing ourselves to not just, you know, X millions of dollars in, you know, unrealized taxes, but we are exposing ourselves to hundreds of millions of dollars in class action lawsuits from people who will say that council made an, you know, overt decision to create two classes of citizens, these that are protected and these are not. And, you know, people went, that was a really, you know, compelling argument. I was like, yeah, because you know what? It is not only the right thing to do, it will cost you a lot of money if you don't do it. And that's one of the things that I like to tell people. You know, we know what our argument's going to be morally. We have to make sure that when we go in, we present an argument that will change the minds and make people understand that there are also financial impacts to doing this. And I think that's one of the things that we have to start doing when it comes to the environment. As a politician, when I run and I start talking about the Green New Deal, one of the things I always talk about is, like, you know, Texas has abundant, you know, wind in the north, water in the south, and sun in the west. You know, the reason we want a Green New Deal is because these things will bring in jobs, and Texas should be the thing populating, you know, should be the thing creating power along the grid for the United States, and should be, manufacturing these things and moving on. People start hearing that argument, they go, okay, well, it's not just tree hugging, it's money. So one of the things that I learned after the fracking ban at HB 40 is that, you know, we have to make sure that our activism takes into account the cynical side and that we present ideas that make people feel a need to have to do it rather than just a want to do it. But, you know, the other lessons is, you know, always be aware of the people you vote for. what they are, or, you know, who they are, and follow the money, because, you know, there was no reason for a fracking ban to be to be overturned. There was no reason to oppose a fracking ban. The whole reason that we were, you know, subjected to this is because people took advantage of, you know, ranchers who never knew that their land would be worth something way more in the future. You know, follow the money.
So before we conclude, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you'd like to address?
Let's see. Denton still does not have a pediatric emergency ward, which is dangerous because we have a lot of kids with asthma because of the bad air. You know, and I touched on the fact that, you know, at some point this is all going to be moot anyway because they pretty much drained, you know, the Barnett Shale. I think I kind of covered everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like that lasting thought. It's the Barnett Shale's drained, but there's still something kind of ongoing, right, if we think about the slow effects.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the thing, you know, I mean, you know, and when I say it's drained, what I mean is that there's not enough out there for them to make billions and billions of dollars, you know, here. But we still have those wells out there. And because they did what they did near those wells, there's still particulates and everything. There's still enough out there to leak into our environment. Those companies just don't want to spend the money to protect us anymore, and they moved on to someplace else. And that's the funny thing. The fracking industry was incredibly irresponsible with how they manage their business, right? That's one thing I've learned, you know, when I'm following up on this. It was almost like a Ponzi scheme because they went in and they tossed out a bunch of money to a bunch of people, built these, you know, they started drilling, kind of pulled all this stuff out, and they would kind of sap all the life out of a particular area and then move on, sap it out, pull it, you know, move it on. And they always expected that, you know, that they were always buoyed by investors. Right. Well, now they reach a point where the Barnett Shale is not as, you know, productive as it was before, and the investors aren't so much there anymore. So now they're all moving to Permian Basin, and it's kind of hard for them to recoup their money, and because they didn't do this right, they've left a lot of things just in ruin, you know, behind them, you know, and that's kind of the way it is with any, you know, exploitative business, right? You know, it's the moral of every children's story about the environment. You know, it's the moral of you know, what happened in the expansion of the West. We had all these buffalo, now they're gone because people came in and shot up all the buffalo. You know, we had lots of, you know, native corns and everything like that that won't grow anymore. Because we've introduced, you know, genetically modified, you know, agriculture into areas, and those become pervasive, and, you know, things that used to grow will never grow again. Fracking industry's kind of done that to Denton, and, you know, how do we fix this? I don't know. It's going to take a long time to grow a lot of trees.
Right. That tentacle metaphor seems pretty pertinent.
Yeah, yeah.
That you use. Well, this concludes the interview. Unless there's one more thing you'd like to add.
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.